This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Now, the digital age is already disturbing enough, but Sarah Bailey takes it to a new level in her latest murder mystery novel, Click. So, Sarah, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Please find attached photo of victim number two, just after her death at 9:40 p.m. yesterday. Regards, the photographer. Who is the picture of and how is it being disseminated?
Yes, the picture is of a recently missing Melbourne woman. She hasn't returned home from a party that she was at on the weekend. And a couple of days later, that message and attached photo is delivered to a major Melbourne newspaper.
The plausibility of such an act of a, well, suspected serial killer, this is number two, using a digital platform for such things.
Pretty plausible. I've spent a little bit of time with Victoria Police and also done a lot of research online. Fortunately, my story is an extreme tale. It's not something that happens all the time. However, there are examples across the globe of digital media being weaponized against people.
And the mindset of such people?
Well, I think like all murder mysteries and all crime writers, I'm tapping into psychology that exists. And again, thankfully with a small percentage of the population, but I think these days they've just got more tools at their disposal and a lot of those are online.
But it sort of gives them validation.
And power,
yeah.
I think a lot of crime is still about power. And when it comes to information, information being used in this way is definitely powerful.
But here we go. We have Ollie Groves, a journalist. She's pursuing the story and she's building a digital media platform, Newsday. But the ethics of releasing such images online, given that these media platforms want clicks, basically.
Yeah, Ollie is a really good journalist. She really has a strong moral compass and she finds herself in a really challenging position in this book because as a business owner, she also has to think about her commercial outcomes. And as we all know, when media is compromised from a commercial perspective, it's really difficult to maintain a very clear moral line. So that's what she's navigating in this story.
But some of these media companies can be manipulated, which is what happens.
That's right.
In your story.
That's right.
So these perpetrators are then using these platforms to further their message.
That's right. It's a complex ecosystem. And in this book, the killer is part of that.
We also then have Ollie Groves' former partner, Dean, who's got a few challenges with his daughters. We'll get into that. But he's an iteration of the, one form of male psychology. Dean has always been attracted to ambitious, assertive women. Once he's in a relationship with them, he resents their autonomy and rails against the very characteristics he was drawn to in the first place. So you've got the male ego, in all its guises, being accentuated through the digital platforms.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the male psychology, all psychology is explored in this book, but there is a couple of specific types of people that I guess I was really keen to tease out. Dean is someone that is attracted to the bright light of someone who does chase down their dreams, but is quite keen to snuff it out once they're within his orbit.
Dean's got daughters. What's the problem there?
Well, specifically in this book, I mean, he's already struggling to be a single dad with twin teenage daughters. But in this instance, he is struggling because the school has informed him that there has been images of his daughters circulating online that are not great because they're not clothed in these images. And he's trying to work out what the hell to do about that.
Well, what the hell to do about it? But why would... Well, how do girls get themselves in those situations in the first place?
Well, that's right. And one of his biggest fears is the fact that his daughters were willingly involved in this photo shoot. It wasn't necessarily taken covertly. And he's trying to grapple with the notion of having tween daughters that are participating in that kind of activity.
But also then they're wanting acknowledgement. They're wanting validation. They're being manipulated by boys. But it's without the foresight of seeing that what goes digital isn't private, it is global.
Yeah, and I guess one of the big themes in the book is validation and the fact that we live our lives online as much as we live them in the real world. Obviously, Dean's children are children, so that makes it's a pretty clear line that that is inappropriate and wrong, and anyone circulating those images is a crime. However, the adults in this book are also seeking validation, and a lot of them are willing participants in behaviour that I think you could argue, while they are aware, it's not necessarily leading to great outcomes.
We also then have the iteration of the male ego in a number of other characters that are very misogynistic. Ned Higgins, an overgrown child.
Yeah, I loved writing Ned. He's sort of a party boy who has managed to convince himself that his absolutely rampant entitlement is justified because he's a good guy who does good things and is involved in lots of charities. And that, in his mind, sort of assuages all of his bad behaviour and sexist mentality.
But it's his parties where these connections have been made, which might lead to some of the crimes that have occurred.
That's right.
A curious one, Hamish. He's now been accused of stalking, but is it really being an ardent admirer? How do we get the balance?
Well, yes, Hamish is a sort of a side character, but another example of someone who has taken it upon himself to, you know, take the real world into the online world and pester people and use imagery against them. And, yeah, it's another example of, I guess, how we're sort of blurring the lines of reality and unreality.
You also have an older case of domestic violence with Douglas Jackson. He's suspected of killing his wife, Mackenzie, so there's that there. But there's a counterpoint to all of this. We've got Detective Constable Penelope Kibbs Penn, who's investigating victim number two. And yet, with a sense of inevitability, Penn pulls the tray closer and opens her laptop, making sure her breasts are covered by bubbles, and logs on to Chatrelet. She desperately wants to meet someone in real life and hear the kind of relationship most people seem to stumble into without even trying. There's a tension here between knowing the danger but wanting connection.
Yeah, well, I think Penelope, who is a detective and arguably should know better, but we all have read the stories of people that should know better and do crazy things anyway, she's interesting because she actually sees the online world as being safer to the real world because of a few things that have happened to her in the past. So she prefers to interact with strangers online from the safety of her own home rather than put herself in harm's way and involve herself in a physical situation where she feels she may or may not be able to defend herself.
But here's the go. Is it safer? I mean, are you actually meeting somebody who is really who they are, or an image of someone they want to project?
Well, I think that is one of the big questions of the book, is what is safer?
Yeah.
Because physically you may be safe when you're interacting with people and things online, but whether or not you're psychologically safe, or ultimately whether or not it might lead to physical danger, is a huge question.
But now you've got to ask the question of Penelope. In the bathtub, bubbles going online.
Yeah, and I think she's an interesting one. I mean, she's obviously suffering from quite a lot of trauma that hasn't really been dealt with. So she's kind of lashing out in a strange way, being almost rebellious from the safety of her home. But she certainly wouldn't want that to be shared with her colleagues. So she's still taking a risk.
She's taking a risk, but she's also a representative of the law in terms of she knows the dangers. So it's almost like she's leading a double life in
that
regard.
That's right, and she would not be the first police officer to do so.
Well, yes. I mean, you've also got her partner here, Barnes, who's going through relationship difficulties, and he's compromised. So, you know, the law is compromised. Police, you know, they're individuals with challenges, emotional challenges of their own.
That's right.
How do you get the right weighting of the law and
Yeah, it's, and you know, I did, like I said, speak to quite a lot of people that work in the police force, and I think a lot of people in that those frontline roles, first responder roles, really do struggle with trauma, and what they're exposed to, I think, really challenges them day to day, and it can enable them to be very effective at their jobs, but outside of work, to really struggle with kind of how to pursue a normal life. And so I wanted to sort of show, I guess, how trauma comes to life in all different kinds of ways.
But just getting back to Lyra Marcus, the victim number two, the photograph, and there was Holm, who was a tourist, who was number one. She's online. She's putting up cooking videos. She wants clicks. We are putting ourselves out there wanting a validation, acknowledgement, acceptance, and yet how do you balance it? How do you get the right?
I think it's similar to, it's kind of calculated risk. You know, I think it's the same reason that we all broadly still drive cars, even though we do know that there is danger there. We sum up our lives and the actions with them and make decisions based on what we feel comfortable with. And that's got, it's a different scale for everybody. All of the people in the book are online to some degree, whether that's for work or for pleasure or for personal validation. And yeah, I think everyone's just deciding what their limits are.
But there are road laws. We have a license. We can be held accountable. There doesn't seem to be any accountability because we can post something to on somebody's feed that's abusive or complimentary. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be any limit.
There is rules and there is increasingly regulation, but it's true that it's not catching up as fast as we would all probably want it to be. I think similar to any rules and regulations, people have always been able to find loopholes and ways to abuse them.
But given you've outlined the psychopathy of all these people, doesn't the digital world allow that to basically explode and escalate and become more rampant?
I think for me, like I'm still online, so while there's lots of things that worry me about the digital realm, and I've obviously explored a lot of them in this book, Click, I am comfortable broadly with being online, but yeah, it amplifies all of the bad and the good of human behaviour.
Which leads to the final level, which is one of political discourse. We've got Clarissa Dunkley, the state premier, whose husband just happens to be a swimming coach, Shane Willoughby, automatically brings about suspicion. But do we have a state of emergency when it comes to domestic violence?
You know, it's so sad that the words swimming coach make you instantly suspicious. It's so ridiculous, but it is just one of those things. Yes, in this book, Premier Dunkley is also after clicks and validation. She is wanting to be re-elected, and she has really platformed domestic violence as a core cause that she supports. But she's not quite willing to rule it a state of emergency. And that, I guess, is a bit of a bugbear for Ollie Groves, the journalist.
But does the digital world make it more prone to, you know, and foster a state of emergency, given how it can escalate things?
Well, the police would say for a crime to be real, it has to be tangible. So, yeah, it's really complicated.
The tangibility of digital world. Oh, dear. There are multiple victims of a suspected serial killer. There is a past domestic violence case, and the murderers are not those whom we initially suspect, as should be the case in a murder mystery. Most frightening of all is the psychology behind the use of social media platforms, where people will post terrible things in order to achieve likes and be affirmed. The novel Click, the author, Sarah Bailey, and it's an Allen and Unwin release. So, Sarah, thank you for talking with me once again.
Thank you.
Well, today I have the pleasure of welcoming into the studio the founder of Bad Dates of Melbourne, Alita Bryden. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. So, your debut novel, or not novel, but in fact book about dating and so on, is called How to Date Like a Dangerous Woman. Now, this is an exciting book. It's full of comedy and humour, and you have this wonderful voice that you bring to this topic. The book straddles not only dating, but boundaries and empowerment in modern relationships. It challenges traditional dating advice and encourages women to approach love and relationships from a position of strength rather than fear or approval seeking.
Oh, I love that review. It's very positive. Thank you so much.
Well,
it's funny that you mention that, because when people read the book, they look back and they say, I can tell you wrote it. It really sounds like you have a strong voice. And I'm like, yeah, it does. I love to tell my jokes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you get quite a few in there. And it's a lovely read. So the title itself, let's talk about that title. What does dating like a dangerous woman mean?
It means that you're out there in the world dating, but you don't put up with rubbish. You have strong boundaries, you know who you are as a person, and you know what you want. So you don't let people take advantage of you. It's a really strong position to be in if you want to date. So we all want to be dangerous women, really.
Yeah, absolutely. The book places a strong emphasis on power and self-worth. For readers who may have struggled with confidence or unhealthy relationship patterns, where do you think that sort of rebuilding this process begins?
Good question. I think a lot of self-reflection. So in the start of the book, I talk about taking time off dating and just being chill by yourself for a while and stepping back from the whole dating app scene, because it can be quite full on. So when you step back, you kind of get to know yourself a little bit better. You've got time to sit with your own thoughts and think about what you really want. So for me in particular, I took 6 months off dating a while back, and it was just by total coincidence. It was because I was starting a new job and I was otherwise busy. But as time went by, like the red flags that I saw when I did get back on the app, the red flags that I saw were even redder, and my rose-colored glasses had come off, and I thought about what I really wanted, and it made dating so much better for me. So I think before you get into a dating book or into dating, it helps to step back from dating for a while.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you make. I'm just going to quote you here. Learning how to be happy alone does not mean you need to be comfortable with loneliness. What made you arrive at that observation?
Ooh, good question. I think when people hear about the single life, especially for women, they think about women at home with, 10 cats, and you're very lonely, and, you have all of this time on your hands, or men don't want you. But it's not really like that for single women, or at least not anymore. We have very rich, fulfilled lives. So being alone doesn't mean you're lonely at all. Like, I fill my life with friends, hobbies, activities, and it's very fulfilling. So this whole idea of being lonely, or that we're lonely, sad cat ladies, it's not really the reality of what it's like for single women anymore. It's much more rich and fun.
That's right. And you did say in your book that you were born single. We're all born single. So the default is really being contentedly single.
Absolutely.
So boundaries. Let's talk boundaries.
I'd love to talk boundaries. Bring it on.
Yeah. So this is a central theme to the book, and they are important for healthy relationships, yet many people still struggle with guilt around enforcing them, particularly women, I have to say. What boundaries do you believe are non-negotiable in modern dating?
Ooh, I think it depends on the person as to what's not non-negotiable for you. I think ones about your body are quite important for people to respect, about your time, and about what you feel is respectful behaviour. So you always want people to respect you. So that's a big one as well. When setting boundaries, I like people to say, if I do X in a situation... I'm not phrasing this very well, but thank you very much. Setting boundaries is very important, yes, and a key part of becoming a dangerous woman.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel that, because I have an 18-year-old daughter, and I feel like I'm Gen X. I think our generation is not particularly great. We're not sort of skilled at carving out our own boundaries and then applying them in a social situation. I'm hoping that's different for younger people. Do you think it might be?
Oh, it is so different. Like, I look at Gen Z and I'm just in awe at the fact that they don't put up with dating rubbish. It is absolutely inspiring. It's absolutely amazing. But in terms of boundaries for Gen X, I think the most important lesson I can convey is that you just need to practice them. Like, things don't always happen naturally for all of us, so the more you practice them, the better you get. So look for situations that are kind of like small stakes where you can start enforcing your boundaries.
Good one.
And then when the time comes when there is a big boundary breach, you'll be able to stand up for yourself much more strongly.
Oh, okay. I really like that advice. Yeah, I feel like I need someone to hold my hand to address the boundary situation.
I believe in you. You can do it.
Yeah, thank you. And I think this book really does encourage you to, you know, press into your own boundaries and maintain them. So is this book for people looking to go on a date? But it also seems that this book is also for people in more established relationships too.
Yeah, like it's a dating book, but it's more than a dating book. I think a lot of dating is about identity. So when you have a strong identity, when you know who you are, when you have high self-esteem, a lot of the dating stuff falls into place. So that those are lessons that are not just for single people. They're lessons for people in relationships as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, excuse me. Do you see this approach as something that applies mainly to early stage dating? So, you know, sometimes I think people might start off in a certain way and then sort of gravitate into another sort of default, which is not so positive. So I guess this is a way that you can bring this book to kind of realign you, yourself and your relationship with more modern values, potentially.
Yeah, look, I think the book is for everyone, essentially. It's really helpful if you're, you know, dating for the first time. But it is also useful if you're in a long-term relationship as well. Like, I think the lessons in there, it's a dating book, but it goes beyond dating. It's about having a strong identity and a happy life.
Okay. That makes total sense. Tell me about Bad Dates of Melbourne. What is this?
Bad Dates of Melbourne. So I'm sure there will be some listeners who know what Bad Dates of Melbourne is, Team BDOM. So about 8.5 years ago, I was a real dating addict. I went on heaps of dates and I had a great time. Like, I swiped until my thumb was calloused. And I had all of these hilarious bad date stories as a result of it. And I would tell my friends and say, oh, you know, X, Y, and Z happened. It was so funny. And they would be like, Alita, these stories are too good to just tell to us. You need to do something with them. So one day, sitting on my couch, just in a moment of, I don't know, just like a moment of lightning bolt, I started up a Facebook page called Bad Dates of Melbourne, where I could share my own bad dating stories. So I was sharing anecdotes and stories and observations. And after a few weeks, people started writing in with their own stories. And I think by about 10 days in, 1.6 million people had seen the page.
Wow.
So it's super popular. Everyone's got bad date stories. And there's about 250,000 followers now. So it's gotten huge. It's massive.
It is huge. Mm. Goodness me. So you can have a chat with Sarah afterwards about it. But yeah, that's incredible. That's fascinating. Is there any sort of advice, final like tips of advice that you might give to people that are wanting to, you know, enter the dating scene?
You know, this could be a little bit controversial, but I think dating apps are underrated. Like, you can meet people on them. You have a lot of variety of people. You might meet people you've never come across before in your life. So people do hate on dating apps, but they are a lot of fun and can be a great way to meet new people.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of far more mainstream now than it used to be. So the book is called How to Date Like a Dangerous Woman. It's by Alita Bryden. And it's HarperCollins.
I was just going to ask a question.
I thought you were saying, let's move on.
No.
I thought you had an announcement to make.
No. I wanted to ask a question.
Go for it. In terms of
bringing it back to Sarah's book.
Yes.
Is the digital world more an artificial? It's the regular platform, but how do you actually know the person for real at the other end? This is my concern with Sarah's.
Oh, you think it might be a bot?
Well, not necessarily a bot, but you can contrive a presence online. You don't necessarily have to be who you are. So when you click on something, how do you know what you're getting is actually real? Whereas if you met them at the church social, they're actually real.
Like, when you meet someone at the church social, they're also going to be putting on airs.
Yeah.
They're going to be putting their best foot forward, so you don't necessarily know. And I think that on social media, you will find people that can be quite fake and phony, but there are genuine people on there as well. So it's a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
I met my partner online, so and we have a baby now. So
and I'm an advocate.
The baby's real.
Is the baby online? Does the baby have a digital presence?
Only through my digital presence. But no, like I think, you know, I agree with what you said. I think that it's there's risk in all of the realms that we operate in, and people can be fake and real in all of them. And you've kind of just got to navigate your way through both the real and the online world, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the same principles still apply, being able to read somebody. I'm just wondering if that's harder to do online than it is in real life face-to-face.
Ooh, it probably is a bit easier to do online because you can really tailor what you put out there. Like, if I post something, I can think about it before I put it out there. But that being said, like I said before, people can be fake in real life as well. Like, don't underestimate how dodgy people can be.
Very true. And, you know, I guess there are certain things that you look for in a post that, or you know, ways of reading someone's sentence or how they've put something together to kind of interpret, or, you know, to pick up on those cues like you would when you meet someone in person as well.
But it also adds, which is a point I didn't raise with Sarah, the notion of deep fakes, because the photographer in this novel, how do we know that the photograph of the victim is actually real?
Yeah.
So what are we seeing and what are we getting?
Yeah, but I think like everyone's been saying, there might be some initial curation that's hard to sort of really get to the bottom of, but if you end up having a real-life interaction, at some point people need to reveal themselves. And I think also the more you're engaging with people online, there's going to be very few people that have sinister intentions, and that's the same online as in the real world, because the real world is the online world. It's the same people.
Unless you come across a serial killer,
yeah,
like which we is do like in Sandra Bailey's
fairly rare. Let's be clear, statistically, very rare.
So this is where I get to wrap up again.
I'm sorry, we did have a little more time, and I thought it was good to try and draw the two together.
Oh, one last thing, I'd like to say, Alita is also a part of the debut crew 2026, along with myself, and just a little shout out to that group. So each year, debut authors, kind of make a little online group, David, and you know, and now I get to meet Alita in person. And we actually go to each other's launches and that sort of thing. So just a little shout out to the debut crew 2026. So this book, again, How to Date Like a Dangerous Woman, is fantastic. I'm going to gift this to my 18-year-old daughter. I think it's full of positivity for her. It's by Alita Bryden and it's HarperCollins. Thanks for being my guest today, Alita.
Thanks for having me.
And I was talking with Sarah Bailey, her novel Click, and it's an Allen and Unwin release.